Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of a beautiful podcast. Today is an exciting episode. I confess I'm a little exhausted. I've just arrived in my hotel in beautiful Cape Town, South Africa, where I was just a few days ago. But in the intervening sort of 5 days, I went to Johannesburg and I saw some of they're basically small mountains with eyeballs, right? They're just amazing. These elephants are just ridiculous. They're humbling. You can't help when you see enough of the world to feel super small anyway. But these, I got to go see some of these just majestic creatures. These majestic creatures out in the on safari, I guess you would say. And that was amazing. And then we went and we did the Johannesburg Spring One Tour event. That was amazing. And then from there, I had to fly to this beautiful island nation in the East Indian Ocean, east of South Africa. It's a 4-hour flight from Johannesburg, called Mauritius. And there is a small little island nation of, I suppose you'd say it's predominantly Hindu, and there's a healthy population of Arabs, of Chinese, I guess there's some white people there. I don't know, but it was just this very interesting place, and people there speak. You walk around and you can hear people speaking, and it's everybody, right? This is the thing, is that you walk around and you hear people speaking French and English, and then some people speaking other, like Mauritian Creole, and then some people speaking Chinese. It was just this absolutely fascinating place. And there I spoke at a small little conference called the Mauritius Software Craftsperson Conference, right? MSCC or devconf.mu or MU hashtag, is the devconf MU. A wonderful experience, and I shall endeavor to return, obviously. And now I'm back in Cape Town. I was in Cape Town, like I say, 5 days ago, but I had some intervening things to do. And here I'm in Cape Town, and then from here I will speak at the Spring One Tour event there, and then tomorrow it's off to Belgrade, Serbia, for the IT Connect event there. So that'll be fun. I look forward to being there on Saturday. That's another new country for me. I'm privileged to be there. So that's cool, right? I guess you can imply from all of this that I'm just pretty pleased with the way this last week has been. It's been humbling to meet so many new people and in these new regions of the world that I haven't yet had the privilege to visit. So I appreciate everybody who's made that experience so pleasant. And I'm also excited about today's guest. I'm excited about today's show. Today we have the privilege of talking to Roy Brahm, who is a solutions architect for Rabobank. Rabobank is a small bank in the Netherlands with just merely tens of thousands. I don't know what it is, maybe 50,000, 60,000, something like that. It's massive, right? A bank in the Netherlands, right? And so they're actually using the stuff you might hear me talk about, right? So I talk about Spring Boot, I talk about Cloud Foundry, I talk about Kubernetes, they're actually out there living sort of the gospel, right? They're actually taking concepts from concept to customer. They're going through the progression and moving work through the value chain into production. And the question then is, how does a large organization that is completely understandably, of course, but still encumbered by regulation, how do you take an organization so encumbered by regulation at such a large size, and then how does that organization move work through the value chain? How does it move it through, the various steps from product management all the way to production, right? And that's what we talk about. That's this discussion. They're all in on Cloud Foundry, Pivotal's Cloud Foundry variant of that in particular, and they're all in on Spring Boot. And I really appreciate the ingenuity that they've put into that above and beyond what comes out of the box, so to speak. And that's representative of their leadership, right? They've just really gone further and farther, faster than a lot of people. And I just really enjoyed the experience to talk to them. They were nice enough to invite me to speak at one of their internal developer conferences a few years ago. Maybe it was last year. I don't know. Either way, just a really interesting organization. And by the way, folks, if you're looking for a job, first of all, you might check with the Rabobank. That might be an interesting place to work. But also, if you're looking for a job, ask them if they have internal developer conferences, if they have facilities that are intended to make it easier for people to better themselves, to improve themselves, because that's the kind of organization you want, a self-improving, you know, learning organization. And Rabobank is just such an organization. You can see that they are super keen on inoculating themselves from not invented here syndrome, right? They want to make sure that they're getting the best out of the ecosystem and building upon that. So I really enjoyed talking to them. I want to thank Roy, of course, for hanging out with me and having this discussion. This was actually recorded a fair bit back. This is, you know, closer. This is the oldest as yet unaired episode. So I'm now from next week, every episode will be far more fresh. but nonetheless, what Roy talks about is timeless. And so that's why I was glad to have this there. As always, my friends, I hope you enjoy the episode. And if you are done listening to this, definitely go check out start.spring.io. Check out start.spring.io and use Spring Boot 2.2 snapshots, because then you'll get Spring Framework 5.2. We just did a milestone. And now you can try out the RSocket support, right? So that's actually in Spring Framework itself now. You can try out the preliminary RSocket support, and you can expect a Spring Tips installment on that from me very, very shortly. So, all right, my friends, enjoy, and I look forward to talking to you next time. Hi, Roy.
Hi, Josh.
How are you?
Fine.
Thanks for joining us today. I know that this is a little late in the evening for you, because you and the bank for which you work are located in the Netherlands, aren't you?
Yeah, that's correct.
Whereabouts exactly?
So our headquarters is in Utrecht, in the center of Holland.
Yeah. Okay. Is that far from Amsterdam?
Yeah, around an hour driving, I think.
So for most people in the States, that would be not far. But for the Netherlands, that seems like another country, doesn't it?
Yes, almost. Yeah, everything is close here. So,
it's a beautiful country. So so tell me about, well, first of all, you're a solutions architect for Rabobank, right? And can you hear that in the background?
Yeah.
Did you hear the calamity that is that sound?
No, like paper or something, are you?
Yeah, trash or something. I don't know. That's actually outside the door. That's not even in the room. amazing, but we could hear it too.
Okay.
Anyway, would you mind giving us a little bit of background first about yourself and then about Rabobank?
Yeah, sure. So like you said, I'm Roy Baum. I work for a small consulting company, and I'm now assigned to the Rabobank. And there I worked for, I think, 4 years as a developer, and now for a year or so as a solution architect. I tried to outline the solutions for the teams, and for two teams now. And then they fill in the details and build stuff. And I hope to build something with them as much as possible, of course. But not always it's possible time-wise. But I still love to develop a lot, of course.
Right on, of course. And when I first met you, I was visiting Rabobank. It feels like couldn't have been more than a month or two ago. And you gave this amazing presentation that I thought was very compelling. You gave a presentation that's the reason why we're on this, why we're having this podcast together, why we're having this interview together, is because that presentation was very inspiring, you know. So one of the things I noticed is that you are obviously
technical, right? You're down in the code a lot, but you had taken a larger sort of business perspective to it as well in that presentation.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so you started with, I think, a discussion of why what you were about to show was difficult because it wasn't done in a vacuum. You mentioned that your organization it's a bank, right? So it contends with a lot of regulation. I mean, can you talk about that challenge? Like you were trying to do a big thing. What is that big thing, first of all? And then can you tell us why that was hampered or perhaps made more difficult by the nature of the organization and the size of the organization?
Yeah, so we got asked to do this presentation on this cloud event seminar we have actually four times a year, like in this big auditorium we have. And then we got asked, like, okay, can you give a cool presentation of the things you're working on? And they say, oh, yeah, and by the way, George Long is also coming. And he's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So we can do this nice presentation of how we can go from nothing to production within an hour. And with nothing, we actually meant really nothing. So not even having a production environment or even a dev environment. So for a year now, we have PCF running in production for the Rabobank, so Pivotal Cloud Foundry. And this makes us actually able to automate everything. So even the whole setup of PCF is automated. So also creating new users and spaces is automated. And we can also, with the CLI, we can actually do everything we want from command line. So we can also automate it in like a Jenkins and do a full deployment in test and full test integration and everything and go to production. And we can show them even though we can build an app and deploy that in production within that hour. But what we also wanted to show is that building some code and of course automation is a lot of work initially. But the hardest thing, of course, that we want to show is that you need to comply with all these regulations. And that you can automate a lot, but you still need to own everything you deploy for your customers. And that's actually what we wanted to show in that hour we had. And that's why we also showed that we need to automate an auditing system if you want to do a continuous integration. So maybe a bit of background how this is organized in Holland. I'm not even sure how this is in different... different countries.
Sure. Now, when you say, are you doing continuous delivery? It sounds like you're able to take a concept and go to production immediately from Git push on into production.
Yeah, correct. So we do this, of course, when we do a pull request merge, then we actually go to production. Yes.
Okay. So yeah, can you tell us a little bit about how it's done in the Netherlands?
Yeah. So for the regulation thing, we have an audit party, which is the Dutch National Bank, which does audits on all the big banks in Holland. And that means that we need to do a lot of reporting and auditing. And we have a system for that, which is kind of hard to click through. So if you want to do continuous deployment, you, of course, also want to automate that. And that's kind of tricky because it has a lot of forms and a lot of things. And everything needs to be filled in because every time you do something in production, it needs to be in that report or in that audit. So it can be later, can be checked by that auditing party. And that was kind of tricky. And for most teams, like how they used to work with this, it's kind of a mess to do this every time. And we showed
actual printed forms?
No, it's not actual printed forms, but there are lots of web forms that you need to fill in.
So every time you deploy something or do something in production, somebody has to fill out this form? I'm not sure. What kind of events trigger the use of these forms?
So even if you do a configuration change, it's actually possible that you need to fill in these forms.
So if you like change the port of a running app, for example.
Oh, yeah, it could be possible, yeah. So there's risks in there that you need to check. So you need to fill in a whole risk form. And that risk form actually determines who to contact for approvals. So that's a whole system behind it that we need to comply with. which is actually, well, if you use it by clicking through it, it's kind of nasty. But if you are able to automate it, it gives you some advantages, because we're really happy with that we actually can go within a couple of minutes to production now. And, well, back in, when we didn't have this, it took us like half an hour or not even an hour. Oh.
When you say click through it, so there's no way to post data to an API somewhere. You actually have to screen scrape this form or something.
No. So there's actually an API that we automated and used for it. Yes, but we didn't have that in the days before.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
Wow. And by the way, going to production in a few minutes or even an hour, even then, that would be a dream for a lot of organizations that I speak to, especially a lot of banks and sort of financial services companies that feel similarly hampered by regulation. So you're saying, oh well, before it was bad because it took an hour, and I think most people look at that and go, yeah, I'll take that. Sign me up. You know, 1 hour sounds great. For them, it's weeks or months.
Yeah. So, like the system that we had before moving to PCF, we had some sort of portlet container environment that we built it ourselves 7 or 8 years ago, which was kind of successful, and that's why we never had had problems with it. But still, and teams can deploy themselves stuff, but still, it took a lot of time because. If you work on a server to upgrade it, you cannot. You're the only one that can upgrade that server, so other teams have to wait. So of course, if you want to do a continuous deployment, you can work with that kind of thing. So that's why we chose 2 years ago something at PCF to make this actually possible. But our team was actually responsible for that. A portlet container environment. So when we did an upgrade, the whole server went down and we upgraded everything. So for us, it was like every time we did an upgrade, we had to upgrade like a 80 servers or something. So it was kind of a trouble for us, and we already automated a lot of that. But
so when we sounds had like a monolith.
Sorry?
It sounds like the production system itself was a monolith, and there's a semaphore on who can change the monolith.
Yes, correct. So we were actually working on the portlet container. And for all the teams, it was not so big problem because they just deploy their wars or ears, and everything works for them. So they can just deploy stuff and can do that all together at once. It doesn't matter. But for us, we had to upgrade the whole container environment. So this means that all those apps goes down and everything beneath that needs to be upgraded. So for us, it was always a problem deploying everything to production.
What was this portlet environment based on, by the way? What was that whole system?
Yeah, it's like with Java, we built with Java and like in the portlet specs, but we didn't use any other portlet environment. We just deployed it on WebSphere.
Okay, WebSphere. Okay, and you wanted to deploy apps without having to go through that tear down and tear up situation. So did you investigated a few clouds? When was this?
I think it all started. 4 years ago, even with an investigation, like okay, these servers are not scalable till at some point the iron is not you cannot pay more for that iron, so you cannot get that iron anymore. So we needed to move to some cloud solution. So first was the investigation, like okay, on which level do we want to. After this, do we want to have a SaaS or a SaaS or a PaaS or whatever we wanted? And that actually started at 4 years ago. And when I joined this whole transition, I think it was 2 years ago. And then the Rabobank Bank selected a couple of vendors, and Pivotal was one of them. And there we actually got the chance. But so the people that selected the platform. They gave a team the chance to test all these environments. And then they say like, okay, you're developers, so you need to work with it. So we want actually the developers to pick the best platform. And that's what we actually did 2 years ago. So, and I was lucky to be in that team to do that.
That's
so
awesome.
Really nice.
Did you, were the people that were working on this, were the people that got to choose the environment, that was a small group, right? That wasn't like the whole company.
Yeah. No, there was a group of, I think, in total, like 10 people or something. Yeah, so one team with the business architect and some guys from the infra department that they actually need to maintain the platform.
And those we selected. So you had buy-in from both infrastructure, from operations more or less, and developers. But that was still just a small pilot sort of effort. At what point did it graduate? I mean, how did you get it to be? I assume it's more than 10 people using it now in your 50,000 person plus size organization.
Yeah, correct. So it kind of got a bit escalated because first we went for a solution for our own department. So I'm in a department for the online banking part. So everything that's been provided to the online banking users goes through our software. And for that software, we wanted a new environment. But because the board actually got a cloud-first strategy, so the board said, okay, with Rabobank, we want to go to the cloud. And we actually say everything needs to go at some point to the cloud, or you need to explain why you can't go to the cloud. And that's, well, typically for banks, some security issues might occur that you cannot go to the cloud. But okay, that's a different thing. And they said, okay, but then we don't want to maintain all kind of different ways of going to the cloud. So we want one preferred way of going to the cloud. And that was actually, they said, let's upgrade this this PCF thing we chose to a Rabobank wide thing to move to the cloud and as a preferred solution of deploying things. So it kind of escalated to like let's say 28 teams are working with it. To, well, I don't know how many teams the Rabobank has, but we have like 3,500 developers or actually persons working in the ICT.
Wow.
IT, so that's big.
Yeah, it is. Very big. It's amazing. Yeah. And are they all sat in Utrecht?
Well, yes, most of them are. We have some locations within Utrecht, but most of them are, yes.
Amazing. So once you got it scaled out a little bit, you had made the strategy to use PCF. Then I guess the next question then would be, once you have a runtime, I mean, you've already established you had existing apps that predate PCF by presumably a decade or more, right? I mean, certainly. So those apps, did you decide at first to do only greenfield on PCF and then leave the existing stuff where it is, or did you try and intend to migrate some existing apps to the new platform while building new stuff on top of it, or
how is it? Yeah, so we are now in the middle of this transition. We as team decided to build everything from scratch. Actually, we had a couple of months to do this because the platform became available, and then we decided to keep it for ourselves for a while to optimize everything and also to let us build all these core components. So I'm in a team that works on core components on top of the PCF platform. So you can think about some user profile service that others call and a edge service that actually directs all the incoming traffic from the outside to the correct microservice. So we decided this is something so different than what we are used to do. We need to build this from scratch. And that's what we actually did in a couple of months. And then we still have, of course, a lot of teams that have their apps running in the old environment that needs to move. And there are lots of different things there, and every team decides how to do this. And some teams are already building some sort of microservices within this old platform and can just pick up and deploy it in PCF, which is no problem. And others need some refactoring. And you also have teams that just start all over.
Right.
That's the moment we're in actually now.
A lot of organizations, it's sort of, at some point software becomes something that is in maintenance mode, and the question then becomes, can you maintain it and still move it, or do you have to rewrite it? And is the application still delivering value? And if it's not, then turn it off or replace it with something new. So there's a natural life cycle point, where it's easy to either rebuild it or redeploy it anyway every 10 years, every whatever your organizational life cycle is. Interesting. All that is super interesting. Now, of course, it's not just Java, right? Do you have other things running on the platform or in your legacy environments that need to move to this new environment?
Yes, but I don't think we're in that point of moving it now. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have mainly focused on Java, most applications, also in the old environment. But now we also give people the chance of deploying all kind of other languages like Node. And you see some Node applications running there. Cool. And we're also investigating how to do page rendering in a cloud way. And then you also have like non-Java, non-GVM languages, of course, that you want to deploy there. So we're now actually in the point that we actually need to decide on these things.
Well, you may know that I happen to like Spring. Is there any Spring in there?
Yeah, so everything we build is currently with Spring. So what we build is with Spring. Some others are using maybe some other frameworks, but most of it is Spring Boot, and cool. All these things.
Oh, interesting. So there's a difference. So how much of it is like traditional Spring before Spring Boot?
So there are some. So the most of the old legacy apps are built with Spring, and some of them are already. So they're good enough to just pick up and move to the cloud, which okay. is done by some teams. And we decided to, because we have a very nice integration in Spring Boot and PCF, so we decided not to do some exotic things, but just go with the Spring Boot stuff and the integration with the PCF, which works perfectly fine. And also because we are like one of the first teams that will do all these things, we also wanted to give some examples of to teams how to do this. So that's why we didn't want to do all fancy stuff with different frameworks. Just wanted to have a proven, stable thing and show other teams that how you can do this very easily.
So that's wonderful. Now, nothing is perfect. Where could PCF be better, and where could Spring be better? Where have you run into problems, basically?
So that's a good question. I don't think we were in real problems at the beginning. Of course, we were kind of shocked by the size of the artifacts, which is of course a lot of people complain about with Spring Boot, or a lot of people. But that's a thing you can complain about.
The so-called fat jars, right?
Yeah, the fat jars. But right. Actually, when you get used to this, it's actually kind of nicely isolated, and you don't have much problems with that.
Yep. And have you seen the new thin jar thing?
Yeah.
So that could solve it.
I also saw the Grail integration with Spring Boot, and I think you also did a presentation about that, which is really nice. So there are nice things coming there.
Cool. And what about PCF? Because you're a team of developers that have been doing things for decades, right? I mean, you're obviously very smart people. And so this platform, as you know, it's opinionated. There's certain opinions that it expects, but it optimizes for velocity. If you can follow these, if you can meet these constraints, like a haiku, you get something out of it, right? Yeah, but I'm sure that wasn't easy for everybody, especially given that you've also got your own opinions and you've also got your own kinds of oddly shaped apps. That's just natural. Everybody has these kinds of things. Yeah. Where did people experience trouble, and what would you tell people to watch out for when they're making this move?
So I don't think I can really have anything against what PCF does. What the biggest problem for me, it was kind of funny. I thought I knew a lot about microservices, and I worked a bit with microservices. But then when you are really going to dive into the microservices, it becomes, at some point I thought like, oh man, I know nothing about microservices. It was so new for us that we were really kind of shocked and felt like juniors again.
I feel like juniors. I feel like a junior all the time too. Yeah, healthy too. Bit of humility is very useful in this space.
Yeah. So that was kind of a shock to me, and I was also shocked about how we are going to do this with a large organization like the Rabobank. Actually, it seems that we have a lot of good developers that have a lot of good opinions on how to do things. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of discussions together, which is actually good. And it changes your point of view once in a while. But actually, the whole thing, like with the 12-factor apps, it's PCF is really great with building your 12-factor apps. It's really gives you so much things that you don't have to care about, which is really, really nice. And
We hope so.
For 90% of our teams, or like 95% of our applications, they just use that, and that's enough for them.
That's good. That's what we want to hear. Were the apps that you already had? You said most of them are in Spring, so I suspect it was not too difficult to make those, to massage them until they were 12-factor apps. But is that, where are some examples where people, you know, where that assumption was false? I mean, did you use, for example, a lot of the file systems, for example, or
hardcore config? Yeah, so in the beginning, we got all kind of nice questions. So we also try to support other teams. It's kind of our way of working within our team, that we help the other teams to move. And some of them, just heard the microservice word, and others are already quite advanced in this. But some funny, or actually for us funny, but for other teams that just don't know, is that they said like, okay, but where can I find the files that I store? And how can I do these things with the configuration? I want to change my configuration file on that instance. How can I do that? And that's kind of a mind shift that people need to be aware of. But it's, we had a lot of cookbooks, a big cookbook with recipes. So we got also some help from some Pivotal employees that helped us with writing these cookbooks, where we actually, every problem that we faced, we tried to make a cookbook from, okay, this is the approach that you need to do to solve this.
Ah, that's interesting. So it sounds, okay. So my friend, Andrew Clay Schaefer,
He says
that the only sustainable differentiator for any given organization today is how quickly they learn. That is to say, you can only reduce the cost of a unit so much. You can only add so many employees. You can only, you know, sell in bulk so much. There's only so many things that you can do to compete with the competition before those things no longer work. But you can keep learning, right? Learning, building an organization that is optimized for institutional learning is the secret to success. So it sounds like as an organization, you were prepared to do this, to make this journey, but also to learn, to make that institutional learning.
Yeah. And that was actually really nice. And of course, we got some help from Pivotal also with how you are going to spread knowledge within the organization, which is of course not so easy because we're still developers, massive, right? And you have different kind of developers, and some developers just focused on their own thing and want to do their own thing, and others are more outgoing.
Yeah. absolutely. And that's, I hope, and again, it's not always true, obviously, but my hope is that with Spring Boot, it is familiar enough for people who are already using Spring so that the journey to Spring Boot isn't so dramatic. It's not a whole different world, you know?
Correct.
Well, that's the hope.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And I think also the problems we see is not with building an app in Spring Boot, because I think that's been made very easily.
Yep.
But I think the bigger problems are domain-specific things, or the Rabobank-specific things. Like, for example, how do you communicate with legacy mainframe applications, and how do you do your TLS setup, and how do you do your key, etc. With these environments. And that's what we actually make cookbooks for, so how people can do that.
And that's the stuff that isn't really seen on an architecture diagram. It's the stuff that it's the details, right? It's the very, very small details that will cause you most of the pain. Anybody who has ever seen me give a talk knows that it's very easy to create a Spring Boot app that responds to an API, you know, to an API call. That's nothing, you know, but getting an app up in production and handling all these other concerns, it's more difficult. And then and integrating with legacy things that we cannot control from the likes of PCF, well, that becomes even more scary. So you mentioned mainframe. Is that a COBOL Kix, that kind of stuff, or what kind of environment is that?
Yeah, so we still have some systems like the old back landscape that we have actually to do the real transactions and get the real customer data. That's still in some COBOL apps already there, which actually are also kind of black boxes for me. They just work.
And, we hope. I said we hope, right? They just work until they don't.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, the Rabobank has all kind of plans to move away from these systems and build new systems, which we're also currently doing. Mm-hmm. But still, we have some legacy apps which we need to do a call, actually, which we do with SOAP and all these kind of older HTTP communication systems.
Wow. So now, okay. So clearly you're doing the right thing from all the tech stuff, you know, from the very specific, you know, what developers want, that's happening. Right. And it sounds like you've managed to scale this organizationally, right? It's no longer just a limited concern for a small group of people. It sounds like a lot of people are embracing this path forward. Did you get buy-in from leadership? Because it's a big organization. I can't imagine that they just sat there quietly, ignorant of the process.
Yeah, well, I don't think... I think you face everywhere this Dutch directness in the organization, so everybody has his opinion, of course.
And, of course.
Which is actually very good. And we also have our opinion. So we try to tell people how we think you should do it, and we have discussions about this, which is good. But that's actually working fine, and the main things we discuss about are like, okay, but how do I do integration tests within our environment? Right. Because maybe good to know is that in our old environment we had five. Well, not so production-like systems, which we call like acceptance systems, which are enterprise-wide acceptance environments, which is giving a lot of headaches to us because everybody needs to upgrade their applications there, like this production. Mm-hmm. But of course, this becomes a problem if you have this with continuous development or deployment, because if this so-called production-like environment keeps on moving as a not so production-like environment, because everybody deploys their apps there really fast and continuously, then this acceptance environment doesn't give you any extras anymore, because it's just a environment that is not even close to a production environment. And the discussions we have around that is actually kind of interesting. And of course, we are still in this process of moving away from our old systems, and I think this discussion is giving us a lot of insights on how not to do it, but also we're still struggling with how we can help teams doing their testing.
But is this good? Sorry, this something on which the leadership of the organization has accepted, basically? Are they bought in?
You mean like that they don't want this anymore? Or they?
No, they do. The strategy of moving to this new thing, is that something that you had to coordinate with leadership, that you had to get buy-in from, for example, I don't know if you have a board or something like that, but...
So that was not done by us, actually, but of course by our business architect. He convinced together with our solution architect for the more infra side. They both... demonstrated what you can do with this platform and why they think it's on the correct level of support, like why we wanted a PaaS, like a PaaS. And they actually quite easily convinced the board that this is a system that we need at the Rabobank, and that it will cover like 90% of all our problems.
Okay, and now when you did that, obviously you can't just go to the board and say, look, this is more fun technically. You know, this is what we want. It's a shiny new framework. I'm sure you had to show them that there was value. And it sounds like you went to them. It sounds like your proposition here was that this will enable you to be more agile, basically, more productive, more get more delivery, more value, more safety. And that's why you had to create this. It sounds like you had to develop it sounds like the real challenge here was the continuous delivery sort of aspect of it, right? The larger goal.
So a nice thing was that we, when they were in the process of selecting a provider or a vendor for this, so at the end we selected PCF, But in that process, the people that were leading this migration project, they actually picked a DevOps team, which was luckily in that team. Mm-hmm. And they picked a team and they say, okay, you're developers, you're a team, and you guys need to work for the coming years with the system. So we want you actually to pick one of those systems we pre-selected, which was actually kind of interesting because the thought was that a DevOps team needs to work with the system continuously. So it doesn't make any sense if somebody that doesn't work every day with the system picks the system that the rest of all the people need to work with. So that was really really interested and interesting, and we did like a POC for a couple of weeks with this, and then at the end we picked Pivotal for with Cloud Foundry to support us with this.
Okay, interesting. And then when you moved to this approach, though, it seems like you, I mean, it's fine to have a cloud, but what good is a cloud if you don't get continuous delivery out of it, right? So
yep.
What was that like? What was the Once you've gotten these technology sort of requirements established, what was the larger continuous delivery goal for you? Like,
yeah,
what did it look like?
Yeah, so from the start, our continuous delivery goal was actually that we don't want to touch anything ourselves. So we don't want to log into something and do something. We just want to have a pipeline that does everything for us, Cloud Foundry supports well with CLI. You can do everything with the command line. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, we stated, okay, we want empty space, and we want to create everything we need for a certain application. We want to create with the pipeline. And if something breaks, we just want to run the pipeline again, and it needs to be fixed. And that was kind of interesting. Because we have Redis or services or other services from the marketplace from Cloud Foundry, and what we do every time is we check if that service exists, and if it doesn't exist, we create a new one. So if you have a new foundation or a new installment of PCF, we can just run the pipeline again, and our whole environment will be set up again. That was actually a goal for us, and we didn't want to do manual stuff in production or do manual stuff with our dev test environment and do manual integration tests. We wanted to be able to automate everything, and that was actually one of the prerequisites of selecting a vendor.
Now, when you built this continuous delivery pipeline, what are the stages in the pipeline? I mean, you've got, you know, the basic continuous integration part where you're doing the unit tests and so on in the code, but what does the larger pipeline look like? What does it mean? Once you get push, what happens?
So yeah, what we did is actually we have a multi-branch pipeline in Jenkins, where we on every feature branch we actually start the whole Spring Boot environment with everything stopped, and with WireMock we stop everything mostly, and then we do a full Spring Boot app, so all our apps are started, and we do a test, like our integration test on that. And then when this all is all green and it can be merged to our development system, our development branch, we do the same, but then we actually deploy everything in PCF dev test. So we have a dev test foundation where we are able to test everything. So we do our full installment there with the actual services provided by PCF, and we do an integration test there again. And then when that's fine, we actually merge the develop branch into the master, and then the same thing happens, but then it happens actually in production.
Oh, so what do you mean in production? You're actually running services calls against live data, for example?
We don't do a full integration test then, of course, in production, because the thing in the Railway Bank is that we don't have real test accounts. Everything is real in production, so also the money.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, so that we cannot do. But what we found, we have a solution for that, is that we have some verification routes. And with these verification routes, we are able to call the actual services and the actual website, but with them within the Railway Bank. So the customers outside the Railway Bank are not able to access that.
Okay.
So we can do a green-blue or blue-green deployment, and we can actually test our new apps with these verification routes without touching the production services the customers are seeing.
So when you say verification route, is this like a tracer bullet where you have a known path through the system that you exercise to see if it works? I mean, or is this actually a URL or something like that?
Yeah, so it's actually a real URL that's by load balancers point to the correct routes and to the correct points in our edge service, and our edge service then makes a distinction to point it to the verification apps or to the real production apps.
Okay, so what is this edge service?
Yeah, so the edge service what you have is that's like a typical edge service like you see within Microsoft worlds, is that for every request from the outside comes to that edge service, and that edge service decides on the domain that you call and the host and the context path. It decides which microservice to call. So it's actually the orchestrator of the dispatching of the requests, and it also does some in-depth security testing. So, for example, we don't do the authentication, but it does the authorization. So we get authentication information, which user logs in, and we check if that user is allowed to access a certain service. And that's actually what all these things are done by the edge service.
Oh, wow. Okay, so in this way, but what if somebody tries to do a write, you know, for the test, and they, you know, like if they update the bank account, isn't that kind of dangerous?
Yes, so that's why we have some real production accounts where we can test this with. So, like I said, we are still figuring a bit out how to do this without an acceptance or an enterprise-wide acceptance environment or test environment. But of course, we have problems now but we have a divorce service, but I don't want to divorce for my wife every time I need to test this. So how are we going to test this in production without a divorce from my wife every time? So we still need to find out how we're going to do that. But yeah, of course, you have the test pyramid, and you can, in theory, you can say, okay, look at the test pyramid, and you need to move everything as close to the easy tests. But these kind of things are still kind of hard for us to do. And we need to figure out how to do this, these kind of things.
Amazing. Very amazing. Okay. Wow. So, it sounds like this thing, it sounds like there's been a lot of thought about how to do this and also get it so that it matches reality. And you do it by actually just using, like Chuck Norris, use production, which is pretty cool.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And so you mentioned, okay, so let me see. You're using Git, right? It's 2018. Obviously you're using Git. You mentioned Jenkins. Jenkins is, the standard, right, by far. I think that's a great choice. And then using PCF, and that you go through different promotes. You promote from one environment to another. The merges onto each branch from the developer's branch to the from the individual programmer's branch to the development branch, and then from there to master. Is that done manually by people?
So there's just by a pull request, and of course the team needs to check if it's correct, and then we merge it, yes.
Okay, and good point. So what about verification? Do you do pair programming, or is there like a code review stage or anything like that?
Yeah, so what we already did is that we have some rules within our team, and I think most teams have that the code that we actually produce is always watched by at least 4 eyes. So that's what we always do. But ideally, we do a pair programming or even extreme programming with multiple people on the same screen and keyboard. Nice. Because that's actually one of the rules in our team that we cannot just we cannot blame one person for doing something or something good or something bad. We are a team, and we are responsible for together for this. So that's why we do this pair programming and mob programming or extreme programming, and also the 4i principles on every piece of code that we move in our Git. And especially, of course, in development and the master, everything that's in there has been double checked.
Wow, very cool. Wow. And then from there, okay, so you're reviewing code through the different stages in the pipeline. And from there, what happens to the GitHub issue, or the how do you correlate work in production to issues in the issue tracker, whatever that is? Is that GitHub issues? Is that Jira? I don't know. I mean, what is your...
Yeah, so we use indeed Jira for this.
Okay. Correct. So I know a lot of organizations that actually transition code based on life cycle states in the... in the tracker, for example. So you might say ready for testing, and you set that stage, and then it triggers the push, you know, the movement of but it sounds like you're driving it from the pull request, and then you just manually sync over the ticket.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay, that works fine. And then from there, it's off to production. Well, I'm assuming it goes through the development branch and then the production branch. Yeah. That's interesting. And so you do this per feature? Is this a very... it sounds like you're doing lots of pushes per day, or is it... what's the granularity of a given push to production for you?
Yeah, so I think... I'm not sure. So in the beginning, when we did a lot of new development on these applications, I think we deployed multiple times a day to production. And I think we're now on, let's say, once a day or so, we deploy our new versions into production. So for every piece of story, or actually every functionality we built, we deploy separately to production.
Awesome. Okay, yeah. And so this doesn't... there's no bunching up of pull requests. They're just all... okay. Do you have a rollback strategy?
No, we only try to roll forward.
Good. Yeah,
that's it's easy to say, but until now we never rolled back. We always rolled forward.
Good. I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, is your schema built in such a way that it's easy enough to do tombstone dead records, so that if you need to, you can actually restore the column, for example?
Yeah, so we also don't have that much records in our environment. So other teams do have this problem, but we don't have real persistent data in our applications currently.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And what kind of data are you working with? I'm just curious, is there Oracle? Is there like traditional data stores in there that are... that are part of the system? I mean, obviously, a lot of people use these technologies.
Yeah, so our application doesn't have real persistent stuff, but we have, of course, a lot of caching there. Mm. So on the PCF, we use mostly Redis for this. And but also with the old environment, we have a Cassandra cluster, for example, and we also have a Oracle database cluster where we store the more persistent data.
Oh, interesting. Very cool. Yeah. Okay. So that should be easy enough to adapt into the PCF world, but I'm just wondering if that's already been done or not.
No, so that's also, of course, it has to do with regulation, because storing data in the cloud, of course, as a financial bank as we are, it's not so straightforward, of course.
Right.
We cannot just store everything in the cloud. That's it. Bit harder to do, so we're in the process of finding out how to do this and which paths we need to take for this, like with encryption and all these kind of things.
Yeah. So when you say cloud, is this all running in your own data center, or is any of this running on public cloud infrastructure?
No, everything is running on a public Azure cloud.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's PCF on Azure.
Yeah, correct.
Oh, okay, interesting. So, is there any thought to a hybrid deployment, for example, using local data center and PCF and so on for part of it, and then part of it in Azure?
Yeah, I don't think we're there yet, but mm-hmm. It might become like this. But we actually chose for deploying everything in the public cloud because that's the chosen strategy of the Rabobank, to move everything to the public cloud.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. And
so using Microsoft Azure, that's a very interesting choice too. They're everywhere, aren't they? Azure has data centers. I mean,
yeah, correct.
I know AWS was first, but Microsoft Azure seemed to be really, really serious about being the best, you know?
Yeah.
Good. Well, that's cool. I'm a big Microsoft Azure fan. What was the motivation for choosing that over, for example, AWS?
So we have our own cloud department or cloud teams that actually sure. offer public cloud solutions. Mm-hmm. And when we chose PCF, Azure was the only one that was compliant with all the regulations and the ISO standards, etc., that we needed as bank. So for us, it was actually not a real choice of picking a public cloud. I'm not sure how it is now. I also know that AWS is getting these certificates that's needed for our banking environment. But we might also go there that way.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. It depends on what our cloud teams are choosing, of course.
Sure. And with it, nice thing about PCF is you have the portability to, you know, you just lay down another foundation in the right public cloud infrastructure and just move. You know, should be pretty simple.
Yeah, that's what we aim for, because we don't want this to affect the teams working with it.
Right. No disruptions. We at Pivotal have for a lot of our internal R&D testing, for a lot of for our development itself, we have moved to Google Cloud, right? And we have found that there's just huge savings compared to AWS. Now, this is not the same as going from Azure. Azure is probably just as cheap as Google. I haven't done the math, but we found that we reduced our testing environment tear down and spin up costs by almost as much as half. I mean, some crazy number like that. You know, so I think the competitors, the Microsoft Azures and the Google Clouds, they're really serious about undercutting AWS. And I know that number has decreased a little bit. I mean, in 2015, it was very easy to achieve much cheaper prices. But Amazon, they're not, they're no slouches either, are they? They don't let people have a margin on them for very long. So it perhaps has changed since then. And then we had a blog. I think the Pivotal R&D blog had a post earlier this year about how we saved something like $500,000, more than that. Just simple, like, you know, changes that we applied at scale. Very, very simple changes that we applied at scale that saved us something like $500,000 in our every month in our cloud hosting bill. And we can do that because you have a single place to change a lot of this stuff, right? If you tweak something in Cloud Foundry, if you make a change that affects Cloud Foundry and Cloud Foundry underpins everything else, well, that applies at scale and you get huge ripple effects, basically.
Yeah, and that's what's nice about it, yes.
Yeah. Well, that's really great. That's amazing. So Microsoft Azure, and Microsoft, of course, they know the enterprise. So, of course, they're going to have great support for enterprise requirements like regulations like that. I know that AWS have the government cloud, for example, and they have certain certifications. I wonder what the state of the art is now for in 2018. As we record this, this is almost Q4 2018. Yep. Which is crazy by itself, by the way. Isn't that weird? Anyway, it's almost Q4 2018, and I suspect they're probably already there, but still probably. I wouldn't doubt that Microsoft and the competitors are very hungry to do better. So, interesting. Now, when you have that edge service. That edge service is out there. It sounds like it plays a very important role in the system because it's routing between tests and between real actual applications. How do you make that multi-tenant? How do you make that highly available? And how do you change it? Like, you can't just take it down and have it disappear for 5 minutes, can you?
No, correct. So we have indeed blue-green deployments for this, and we have multiple instances and cross foundations. So we have two foundations for in production, which are actually installments of PCF on different
data centers,
availability zones.
Or availability zones, yeah.
Yeah, so we have two Azure clusters where we install this on. And of course, we blue-green deploy on every foundation separately. And like I said, with the verification routing, we are actually able to deploy one instance as a new instance and direct all the routes for the verification route to it. So we can actually test it manually or automated, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And then if that looks good, and we also have our monitoring in place, we look at the monitoring if nothing goes wrong, and then we scale that new instance up with the route of the real customers, and we look at our monitor if everything goes well, and that's how we actually proceed with rolling out our new service and rolling down our old version. And that's how we do it separately on each foundation.
And if you change the routes themselves, is that a configuration change or?
Yeah, so that's what we actually do with the CF CLI. So we just bind the new routes to our, or the old routes, the production routes to our new instance. And yeah, we can just do it with the pipeline. So it's all within our Jenkins pipeline. We also build a library around this because we also saw that we had, I think, 4 services that we need to deploy. We were continuously doing the same thing within Jenkins. So we made a nice Jenkins pipeline library, which we use as sort of build a pattern to deploy all our stuff. And there we also have this this turning around the routes to the new instances built in.
I see. Okay, amazing. Okay, my friend, this has been very insightful. I've learned a lot. I can't believe all the crazy cool things you're able to do already. It's great to hear about these kinds of stories because a lot of times I visit different customers and different organizations that are using these technologies, and they're struggling, right? You know, understandably, because they're doing something that is. It's one thing for a startup to do what we're doing, to do what you're talking about. But you see large organizations with actual money on the line, right? You know, Rabobank is not, they're not broke, you know, they're not looking for money. When you have actual organizations with actual money on the line and they're heavily regulated and understandably, it seems like there can be a whole lot of challenges to the process that have nothing to do with technology itself. And so to see that you can effectively navigate those ordinance challenges, those regulatory challenges, while also overcoming technical challenges, that's very inspiring. I think people are going to love this this interview.
It's not easy, but we try to do this, and like you said, I feel like a junior every day because every day you learn something new and you see like, okay, this is some challenges we need to tackle. So but it's nice.
It is very nice. Now, Roy, thank you for your time. Where can people find you? Where are you online? Are you on Twitter? Is there an email you want to give out? Whatever. So people who are inspired by you can reach out.
Yeah, sure. So my Twitter handle is rbraam. So B-R-A-A-M. You can reach me out. Reach out to me there.
Okay. Anything else you want to leave people with? Is Rabobank hiring? It sounds like a great place to be.
Well, of course, it's a great place to work on, and probably we are hiring every day new people. So,
awesome.
Please look out for us and come join us in this great adventure.
All right, thank you so much, Roy. I appreciate your time.
Thanks. You too. Thanks for having me.
Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at starbuxman on Twitter, where of course my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as that really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs's Them from Morning and Springtime and Steve Combs's Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.